I next met with Dr. Greg Riley, who began our conversation by presenting a patient from his practice.
So this is a really nice 70-year-old woman, African-American, never smoker. She initially presented to her primary care doctor mainly complaining of pain when she sneezed. There wasn't much to make of it by her primary care doctor initially. He eventually did a chest x-ray, which showed a 2-centimeter left upper lobe mass. And to follow that up, they did a CT scan. The CT scan showed that left upper lobe mass, but more importantly, and really to what caused her symptoms, she had relatively significant pleural base disease, not a large pleural effusion, just multiple pleural nodules, which was probably the cause for this pain when she sneezed.
So where exactly was the pain? And for example, did she have it when she breathed?
Yeah, she didn't have it when she breathed. So it wasn't what you'd consider classical pleuritic chest pain or, you know, pain with deep breaths. And it only bothered her when she sneezed or when she, for one reason or another, coughed, though it wasn't really causing her much cough.
And what was her overall health and comorbidity status?
She had diet-controlled diabetes and was otherwise well.
So what about the workup?
So her initial evaluation included a PET scan, which showed no other sites of metastases, and an MRI of the brain, which showed no evidence of brain metastases.
Now, is that when you saw her, or it was a little bit later?
I saw her actually just a little bit. I ordered the PET scan, I ordered the MRI. And once we got these results back, I also got back her mutation testing results. I ordered her EGFR KRAS mutation testing along with the PET scan and MRI of the brain to complete her initial clinical staging and molecular staging.
And how was the tissue accessed?
She had had a core needle biopsy of the left upper lobe lesion.
And was that, again, done by you all?
Yeah, it was requested by one of our surgeons performed at Memorial Sloan Kettering.
Just out of curiosity, what do you see in terms of the types of biopsies that are being done nowadays, and how often do you get cores that have, you know, enough tissue to do genomic analyses?
I have to say that's one thing that's really pleased me that I've seen over the last 5 years is that the frequency of core biopsies is really going up significantly. Certainly, it's not every patient that has adequate tissue for mutation testing from the start, but I would say we're nearly the majority of patients now come in with having had a core biopsy and actually having enough tissue that we're able to determine EGFR and KRAS relatively easily.
Now, just out of curiosity, at your place, do you also get EML4 ALK on non-smokers? Do you wait and see the EGFR mutation? How do you approach that?
We have a staged evaluation where we initially evaluate for EGFR and KRAS mutations. It's now done essentially in parallel for both those. And then if either of those are positive, so if a patient has an EGFR mutation or a KRAS mutation, we stop there because we know that those are driver mutations which are unlikely to occur in common with an ALK translocation. If both of those are negative, then we will go on to do the ALK FISH, looking for a variety of rearrangements which can lead to activation of ALK, so the EML4 ALK being the most common.
Just out of curiosity, what were you expecting the tissue analysis was going to show on her?
So she was a never smoker, and I certainly thought that given her never smoking history, that it would be likely that she had an EGFR mutation. There has been some work published suggesting that African American patients have a somewhat lower incidence of EGFR mutations. This was actually published probably a year ago in the JCO suggesting that. And that actually prompted us because that wasn't our institutional experience that patients who were African American, our sense was that they had an equivalent likelihood of EGFR mutation to say, a Caucasian person, certainly nowhere near as frequent as you see with Asian Americans, but certainly frequent nonetheless. And that prompted us to actually go back and look at our series of patients. And we recently published in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology data from a large number of patients, both Caucasian and African American, which demonstrate that EGFR mutations are essentially just as frequent among African Americans as Caucasians.
So at your place, would her smoking history alter the workup in terms of what you look at in tissue? For example, let's say she was a current smoker.
You know, we don't bias ourselves based upon smoking history. Certainly, we were some of the folks who initially noticed the associations with cigarette smoking, Vince Miller being one of the lead folks on that. But we also realized that even folks who have a significant smoking history can still have ALK rearrangements. Those patients can still have EGFR mutations. And given that patients who have a heavy smoking history represent such a large proportion of our patients, even a low frequency of, say, an EGFR mutation in that population of patients, if we didn't test them, we'd be missing a large number of patients.
Got to say, I've heard you say that before, and yet I'll say that that's pretty different than the way a lot of other people look at it, other institutions, other investigators, people in practice. I buy into your model. I mean, it's like breast cancer. We don't decide who we send to ER and HER2, but I don't know that what you're doing is exactly what everybody else is doing.
And I think you're right. I certainly see that in patients referred to me that we're missing out on some EGFR mutations just because we take their smoking history and decide right then and there what we think is a likely molecular abnormality for that patient when it's not really enough data to make that decision.
Okay, so I'm putting my money on. She had a mutation. She's on erlotinib. Everything went away and she's doing great.
Well, you know, actually she got her prescription for erlotinib and went to the drugstore. I presented erlotinib and a clinical trial with a developing agent, a second generation EGFR inhibitor called BIBW2992.
So she was mutation positive?
Yeah, she ended up being mutation positive. So I presented standard of care with erlotinib, which we consider initial treatment with erlotinib as standard of care for patients with EGFR mutations, and enrollment in a clinical trial. She initially was skeptical of enrollment in a clinical trial, but took her prescription to the drugstore and found out that her copayment each month would be $1,000. And so she came back to the office and asked about that research study again.
And what do we know about this new agent, the irreversible EGFR TKI? And what is this trial looking at?
So BIBW2992 is a irreversible epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitor that also seems to inhibit the HER2 pathway as well. There's some thought that by both of those characteristics, that is, it's being irreversible and it hitting HER2, that may improve its activity against EGFR mutant lung cancer.
And actually, I heard that agent discussed in our breast cancer think tank a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's being explored in a variety of indications. So the drug is currently in an investigation in a handful of different areas. There's an ongoing randomized trial comparing cisplatin pemetrexed to BIBW2992 in upfront treatment of patients with EGFR mutations.
So like sonivipass?
Exactly, like sonivipass, specifically accruing only patients with EGFR mutations and using the state-of-the-art chemotherapy. That study is actually, I believe, accrued completely, and well, we're waiting for the results.
Hmm. And what's the study that she actually entered?
So she started this study about 2.5 years ago, and it was a simple phase 2 non-randomized study only for patients with EGFR mutations to get a sense of the response rate initially.
And what actually happened to her?
So she has had disease control for the past 2 years and continues to do well.
Wow. What do we know about, I mean, I guess this could have happened with erlotinib also.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the median progression-free survival with erlotinib or gefitinib in patients with EGFR mutations is around 9 to 10 months. But that, as we all know, the median is not the message, and there are patients who do very well, and there are patients who do very poorly. So certainly we all have a handful of patients who don't respond initially to erlotinib or gefitinib. But I have the luxury of being at an institution where some patients, even treated by some of my colleagues before I began as an attending physician, were put on gefitinib or erlotinib, and now they're under my care. And so I have patients who are still taking gefitinib since its initial use back in the expanded access program in the early 2000s. I have patients who've been on erlotinib for more than 7 years. So I think that there are certainly large numbers of patients who can do long periods of time on these drugs without any evidence of progression.
So what happened to this woman's sort of sneezing slash pleuritic pain and the mass?
So that was certainly the most gratifying thing is she came in to see me 2 weeks later and she says that she can sneeze and she can cough and not have any pain at all. And within 2 weeks, she actually had essentially complete resolution of her cough. On the CT scan, which I obtained about 4 weeks after starting BIBW2992, she had a partial response, just as you'd expect to see with erlotinib treatment.
And what happened in terms of side effects and toxicity with her?
She's had the expected side effects associated with an EGFR inhibitor. So she's had rash, she's had paronychia, but beyond that, she hasn't had any significant difficulties.
So you have the king of dermatologic oncology, Mario Lacouture, in your place now that you grabbed out of Northwestern. And he a lot of times talks about preventive therapy for patients getting EGFR inhibitors, TKIs, and antibodies. Are you doing that? And did you do it with her?
We absolutely are. You know, she started this medicine before he arrived, but she has since become a patient of his. So she definitely sees him frequently. And you're right, he's a big advocate of trying to prevent the rash from occurring from the start. And I have to say, I'm in full support of that, because when we start these drugs, patients, and we show the CT scans to them demonstrating great response, they're always happy with that part. But when they have a severe rash, sometimes that rash occurs even before we get to the CAT scan. And it's a very discouraging thing because, you know, unlike a lot of chemotherapy side effects, which can last for a few days and then resolve, these EGFR TKI rashes last continually, as long as you're on the medicine, pretty much. And so we have to develop ways to, if we can, prevent them. That's wonderful. And once they occur, to do a better job of managing them.
So looking back over her course, would you say this has been not a big problem, you know, pretty significant problem, on and off? Globally, how's it been for her?
Well, you know, it's really always amazing to me the differential between the doctor's perspective and the patient's perspective on these things. Every patient's different, of course, but when she comes in to see me, I look at her hands, and I look at her face, and I say, you know, this is quite a rash. You know, this seems like we maybe even should consider a dose reduction, even though it's only a grade one or grade two rash, but it seems like this would be very difficult for you. And she says, no, doctor, this stuff is working very well for me. I don't have any pain. I feel good. I don't mind these side effects.
I guess particularly if you think about cytotoxic chemotherapy. One final issue before we get on to your next patient. In terms of this new generation of TKIs, similar to what she's getting, what do we know right now in terms of efficacy compared to the traditional agents? What do we know about responses in people who clearly have, you know, some kind of defined type of resistance, the quote T790? And what about side effects? About the same, worse or better?
I think our general consensus among folks who treat a lot of patients with the second generation inhibitors, so this BIBW2992 and then a compound called PF0029984, which is another second generation EGFR HER2 drug, these seem to cause somewhat more rash than we see with erlotinib, and still a little bit more rash than we would see with gefitinib. And I think that it's always hard to know whether that's just a perception of doctors involved in clinical trials, because these drugs aren't widely available yet. Because when we're treating patients on trials, we're somewhat more hesitant to dose reduce than we are with patients who are treating off trial. So it's hard for me to know for sure, but I would say that the type of side effects we see are essentially the same. There may be some greater intensity of those side effects, though.
So how about efficacy?
So efficacy, we don't have great data yet. So with the BIBW2992, there was a randomized trial in the setting of acquired resistance to gefitinib and erlotinib. This is a large randomized study presented last fall at ESMO. So the initial results were that the progression-free survival was significantly better for BIBW2992 as compared to placebo. I guess we shouldn't be surprised by that. Something is going to do better than nothing. But perhaps the more interesting thing was that the overall survival was exactly the same, suggesting that these patients with EGFR mutations, as we all know, they respond relatively well to chemotherapy, and they continue that initial response to chemotherapy, and they do well with other chemotherapies too. And I think that it's really hard to know what the right trial design is in that setting, but I think one could certainly consider comparing some of these new agents to continuation of the prior EGFR TKI.
You know, sometimes hearing about individual patients can help a lot. And I guess I'd be curious to know, are there people who are absolutely progressing on an agent like erlotinib, had the erlotinib stopped, got started on one of these agents and had a response? No chemo, just the agent.
I believe there is no patient who's had a documented response in that setting where they come straight off of erlotinib and then go on to BIBW2992 or any of these second generation inhibitors. Unfortunately, when we design these trials, we want to try to include as many patients as possible. And sometimes we include patients who stopped erlotinib 6 months ago, received 4 months of single-agent pemetrexed or a single-agent docetaxel, and then go on study. And we have seen partial responses in that setting, But again, it's uncertain as to whether that represents a retreatment effect that you would have seen with the first generation inhibitor alone.
Right. So let's talk about your 55-year-old woman.
So this is a 55-year-old lady who initially presented with cough. She was seen by a primary care physician who got a chest x-ray and noticed an infiltrate in the right lung. She received antibiotics for about 2 weeks. Cough still there, infiltrate still there. Tried another antibiotic, another two-week course, and the cough is progressing during this time. The primary care physician then arranged for referral to a pulmonologist. The pulmonologist did a CT scan, and he sees this large right lower lobe infiltrate. And there is one lesion in the pleura on the right as well. There's a small pleural effusion on this CT scan that was not noted on the initial chest x-ray. So the pulmonologist performs bronchoscopy, obtaining transbronchial biopsy, and diagnoses adenocarcinoma. Based upon the pleural involvement and on subsequent PET scan, a single site of bony metastases was identified. The patient was diagnosed with stage 4 adenocarcinoma of the lung involving pleura and bone.
And again, her smoking history?
So she smoked 5 pack years. So this is a patient who, no matter who you are, you would think that testing them for EGFR mutations would be important. And we did send her tumor material for EGFR and KRAS mutation testing. Both of them were negative.
And how about her EML4 ALK?
She was initially treated about 3.5 years ago. So we didn't have that data at the time. But in the last 6 months, we have noted that she does have an ALK rearrangement.
Wow. Okay, well, let's just put a pause on that for a second and go back to, so this is the pre-ALK days. What's that, like a year and a half ago or something? And so you saw that she had adenocarcinoma. What were you thinking about as options at that point and what actually happened?
So this is about 3.5 years ago, and the options that really that were available at the time were carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, or other standard platinum-based doublets. So with her, she's relatively young. She had no other comorbidities. I didn't mention she had an MRI of the brain that showed no evidence of brain metastases. She had no central tumor. She had no hemoptysis. And so we decided to proceed with carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab.
Now, was she symptomatic from the tumor?
The cough, I think, was related to the tumor.
And what happened?
So she did extraordinarily well. She had, and I would say, about 80% shrinkage of her primary tumor, and the single site of bony metastases on PET scan became quite sclerotic, suggesting a good response to therapy. She completed her 6 cycles of carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab and then received bevacizumab maintenance.
How did she do in terms of tolerability to both the chemo bev and the bev?
She did very well with the chemotherapy and bevacizumab. She had alopecia, of course, and she had one episode of neutropenia without fever, causing dose delay in the 6th cycle, but otherwise did quite well. And during the course of her bevacizumab maintenance, she also did well. She did have some mild hypertension during the course of bevacizumab maintenance, started an ACE inhibitor, and that controlled that hypertension without difficulty.
Just out of curiosity, any nasal problems, any bleeding, for example?
You know, I would say that 75% of my patients, if I ask them specifically whether they're having any blood in what they blow out of their nose, they say yes if they're receiving bevacizumab. And probably about 15 or 20% of patients receiving other chemotherapy say yes to that question, especially here in the dry winters of the Northeast.
So I want to come back a little bit to this, but let's just keep going with what happened. It's so interesting to think about, you know, somebody diagnosed 3.5 years ago versus 2 years ago versus 6 months. It really tells you where the field's going. And I'm trying to remember 3.5 years ago where the issue of maintenance was. I'm not sure it really come on board yet.
No, it hadn't. And I think this was actually before we even had access to pemetrexed in the first line. It was
right.
The days when the state of the art was carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab.
So what actually happened to her? She's on the Bev alone.
She actually stayed on maintenance bevacizumab for 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah. She did extraordinarily well. And then that area in the right lower lobe that had responded so well started to increase in size. And when I noted that, actually we made a transition, stopped the bevacizumab, and began pemetrexed chemotherapy.
And then what happened?
She actually stayed on pemetrexed for about a year. The initial response to treatment was not profound. I would say that she had about a 25% reduction in the tumor size, but clear reduction in the primary tumor, and then it essentially stayed about that same size for about 9 months until it started to grow a little bit. by 12 months, it was clearly growing.
Then what?
Once the tumor started to grow a little bit, that's when I asked her to go back to the original hospital where she had her bronchoscopy and see what she could find in terms of unstained slides. And she brought in 15 unstained slides for us, and we tested them for the ALK rearrangement, and she had the ALK rearrangement.
Wow, what a story. This is like the history of pulmonary oncology all in one case.
That's right.
So then what? You got her on a crizotinib trial?
Yeah, so she went on a crizotinib trial about 9 months ago, and she continues to respond well to treatment.
Wow. Any side effects or toxicity with the crizotinib?
She had initial lower extremity edema during her treatment with crizotinib. We managed it with a little bit of diuretic, and she responded well to that, and she's actually been quite well since then. Actually, another sort of side note is before I knew her ALK results, she was having difficulty with peripheral access, and we placed a Metaport, and with the Metaport about just a month before starting crizotinib, she developed a clot at the Metaport site, so she's been on low molecular weight heparin since then, and I've been cursing myself for getting a Metaport when I was about to start it on an oral agent.
Unbelievable. Wow. Where do we even start here? Before we go back, is edema been reported with crizotinib, and what's the mechanism?
Yeah, we don't know the mechanism, but it certainly does occur. It's something we definitely see and can quite easily be managed with a low-dose diuretic. It's never dose-limiting.
But this is a TKI?
Yes, right.
Is it fluid overload or a vasculitis?
It probably is a bit of a combination of fluid overload and vasculitis. We certainly never see fluid retention like you see with docetaxel or pemetrexed, so it's not a true fluid retention like that. But I think that certainly some of these small molecule kinase inhibitors have off-target effects that can lead to edema. We certainly see that with some of the CML drugs like imatinib.
Right. So again, I got 15 questions written down here. Let me just throw a few of them at you. Now, you said she got carbo-paclitaxel Bev, and I know there are times I've heard you and other people from Memorial talking about cysts in metastatic disease. Do you use cysts, and did you think about it with her?
Yeah, I'm definitely an advocate for using cisplatin. For her, I guess I can't really rethink what I was doing at the time, but my rationale probably in retrospect was that the strongest data was carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab, and I wanted to use an evidence-based regimen.
Now, another issue in her, and again, I've heard about this discussed in terms of EGFR TKIs in mutation carriers. Do you keep it going if they've had a great response and then they have progression, kind of like the trastuzumab thing in breast cancer? Do you treat them for life? First of all, do you do that with EGFR TKIs? But what about the unusual patient like this one who has this seemingly really long response to chemo-bev followed by bev? I mean, did you think about keeping the bev going?
Yeah, I definitely strongly thought about it. But at the same time, I knew that she'd been doing well for, I guess at that point it was 3 years, and I thought that given the relatively nonspecific nature of bevacizumab's benefit, that we probably had outlived the benefit and we were seeing clear progression on bevacizumab alone. So for her, I did discontinue bevacizumab. Now, on the other hand, you can probably find intellectual inconsistencies here, but certainly for patients who have EGFR mutations who respond well to erlotinib and then develop progressive disease, I think our first line of managing those patients should be enrollment in clinical trials, but even at a center like ours, there's not always a clinical trial that's available at the right time, and you have to come up with treatment decisions off protocol. And for those patients with EGFR mutations who have a clear response to erlotinib, I do continue erlotinib, and I add additional chemotherapy on top of that. I would love to see the results of a randomized trial to support that what I'm doing makes sense. In the absence of a randomized trial, what I go back to is a small study that we performed at my institution and I wrote up a couple of years ago, where we took patients with EGFR mutations who were developing resistance, and we did a lot of scans. We did a CAT scan and a PET scan. We stopped their erlotinib, watched what happened to the tumor. So clearly these patients had developed resistance, and when we stopped the drug, their tumors grew and became more FDG avid on the PET scan. But then we decided to restart the erlotinib and gefitinib, or erlotinib or gefitinib, depending on the patient, and we again scanned them to see what would happen. And just 3 weeks off drug, 3 weeks back on it, we saw a relatively clear flare in the size of the tumor, and a number of our patients even had flares in their symptoms during that 3 weeks off of erlotinib. And then when we restarted the erlotinib, we saw tumors either shrink again or at least stabilize, and a number of patients had their symptoms improve again.
Well, certainly, you know, a treatment with a TKI for, you know, quote, oncogene addiction is pretty different than anti-VEGF therapy. So I think, you know, I can personally see that you might approach it differently. You mentioned that she had a bone met. Where was it? And did you put her on bisphosphonates?
She had a right-sided rib lesion. She received, I think it was about a year of every 3 month bisphosphonate, in this case, zoledronic acid. And then actually she had some change in her jaw, and I sent her to a dentist, and the dentist said that this is likely osteonecrosis of the jaw. And as such, I stopped zoledronic acid at that time, and we continued to monitor her bone mets at that point.
When you say she had changes, were that clinical or on x-ray?
Well, she was experiencing some pain, and she noticed one of her teeth was not as well seated as it usually was. She had a loose tooth, essentially.
What did you see when you looked in her mouth?
You know, I actually didn't see anything, and certainly that's one of the presentations of osteonecrosis of the jaw, is that you don't see anything when the untrained oncologist such as me looks in the mouth.
So I guess that was while she was getting the chemo Bev, right? And the Bev.
This was actually, yeah, she was just getting Bev alone at the time.
And I guess there was this question about was there more ONJ or worse ONJ in people on Bev? And I think it was actually Memorial, I forget which tumor, that sort of came up with some data saying maybe not.
Yeah, there is a wide variety of things that have been potentially associated with osteonecrosis of the jaw. Zoledronic acid, bevacizumab, some of the newer agents, VEGF trap has also been associated with it. But I think that it's not really clear associations with anything but zoledronic acid.
So am I correct in saying there's not much data to say that people either get more frequent or worse ONJ if they're on Bev with zoledronic acid or not?
I think that's correct.
Again, thinking about the rapid change in lung cancer, I'm curious, you know, this is 3.5 years ago she presented. If she were to present today, what do you think you'd be thinking about, particularly in terms of your initial chemo slash Bev and maintenance plan?
Certainly things have changed a lot since this woman came in. And I think that your first line chemotherapy in a patient with an ALK rearrangement, unfortunately, is restricted by which clinical trials are available. So without a ALK inhibitor clinical trial that is available in the first line, she would receive a first line platinum-based doublet for this situation, with or without bevacizumab, of course. And so for her in this situation, I'm likely to give similar chemotherapy to what she got in the sense that I would do a platinum-based doublet with bevacizumab. But given the improved tolerability profile of pemetrexed compared to paclitaxel, i.e. patients don't lose their hair, that's usually my upfront choice. So I would likely treat her with cisplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab today.
And, you know, I guess I'd say based on our polls of investigators that they'd be right on there with the pem and the bev, but, you know, just the only difference might be the carbo.
Right.
But it is interesting that people, I guess there's no actual randomized comparison yet of pem, carbo Bev versus carbo paclitaxel Bev.
Right, and there's no comparison between carboplatin pemetrexed Bev and carboplatin pemetrexed. And then we start to figure out all the various iterations that people are starting to do trials for, you know, deciding which drug you should get in maintenance in that situation. So if you start off with carboplatin pemetrexed bevacizumab, do you continue maintenance therapy with bevacizumab alone, or do you continue bevacizumab and pemetrexed? Certainly, the options are both there, and it's a difficult question. I have to say that personally, I generally end up doing a continuation of pemetrexed and bevacizumab and then discontinue the carboplatin or cisplatin when patients have difficulty tolerating it.
And I guess, as you say, the term that's sort of come about has been continuation maintenance. And then the other would be so-called switch maintenance, which seems to be mainly people stopping paclitaxel with carbo-bev and starting PEM in some way.
Right, exactly. You know, that's the historical sense of the initial pemetrexed maintenance data, was that none of the patients received pemetrexed in the first line. So in order to use pemetrexed as a maintenance therapy and what the FDA label recommends, you have to be switching from a different platinum-based doublet to pemetrexed. So right? Patients who are receiving carboplatin paclitaxel alone, carboplatin docetaxel, would then switch over to pemetrexed.
What about the option, again, today as opposed to 3.5 years ago, of integrating nab-paclitaxel, either in a case like this or maybe more so in a patient with squamous cell? But I guess that agent, we saw some data on the ASCO 2010 meeting. What was your take on that, and where do you think things are heading?
I think nab-paclitaxel has, as in the breast cancer world, we're seeing in lung cancer that people are initially studying it because it has reduced hypersensitivity, and in some ways, it's a easier drug to deliver. Maybe it can be delivered more quickly than paclitaxel, and certainly we don't have the risks associated with hypersensitivity reactions, which I think are most oncologists' biggest fears when they get the call from the chemo suite on their patient who's just starting the paclitaxel-based chemotherapy. So that was why it was initially evaluated in lung cancer, and it actually has shown to have every bit of efficacy as paclitaxel in that setting. But there are some data that are beginning to be generated suggesting that nab-paclitaxel may work a little bit better for squamous cell lung cancer. And I think that that's early data, and there's some preclinical rationale that can be derived to support that initial clinical observation. But what we really need as we move forward is to have some prospective trials which accumulate just patients with squamous cell lung cancer. As you know, a lot of the big advancements in lung cancer, EGFR mutations, ALK, pemetrexed, bevacizumab, these are all things that are really restricted to patients with adenocarcinoma. And the number of patients who have squamous cell carcinoma, while it's small, is still a significant proportion of patients with non-small cell lung cancer. And something like nab-paclitaxel may be a good option in that setting, but we do need more trials to really evaluate that.
Just out of curiosity, what tends to be your initial systemic therapy in metastatic squamous cell?
I actually use gemcitabine cisplatin if I can in terms of cisplatin versus carboplatin. And otherwise, I think gemcitabine carboplatin is reasonable. I do prefer those to carboplatin paclitaxel, but not for any evidence base.
And so I take it you haven't tried NAB?
You know, our institution is a little bit tight with allowing us to use albumin-bound paclitaxel. The setting in which I've used it a number of times is in patients who have a hypersensitivity reaction to paclitaxel or docetaxel. Then I make the switch to albumin-bound paclitaxel.
Yeah, we have sort of been curious about this whole thing in breast cancer now for years. And one of my favorite questions in polls in breast cancer is, if nab-paclitaxel and paclitaxel were both equivalent from the point of view of reimbursement and cost, they're both generic, would you use paclitaxel at all?
I'm sure the answer is no.
Yeah. Anyhow, we thus enter the complex world of practical oncology. But again, sort of getting back to this case and, you know, sort of what it tells us about where we are. Just one thing, you know, you can see just listening to you as well as anybody that you need to approach adenocarcinoma very differently than squamous cell carcinoma in terms of advanced disease. How often do you think that they're kind of errors in diagnosis, or maybe error is not the right word, but where, you know, we maybe are thinking something's one and it's really the other?
Yeah, the lack of concordance amongst pathologists is relatively a significant problem. You know, until 2004, the medical oncologist who was getting the report didn't really care whether it was an adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma. We treated them exactly the same. So our pathologists who were working up to that point were comfortable making the diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer, but they didn't have maybe the same level of sophistication in making the distinction between adenocarcinoma and squamous histology. So since the initial bevacizumab data, there's been a whole host of other data, including the EGFR world, as well as pemetrexed, that has demanded from the pathologist that they distinguish these two. But not in all situations are they comfortable making that distinction. So just making the distinction is the first step that we have to do. And then once they make the distinction, we have to understand whether their decisions are necessarily concordant with other pathologists. And I certainly see situations in which a patient comes to me with an outside report that says squamous cell carcinoma, and I have one of our thoracic pathologists take a look at it, and they say it's an adenocarcinoma.
That's a little bit disturbing.
Well, you know, it's disturbing on one level, but I have to understand.
How can that be in a way? I mean, I could see if there's not adequate tissue or sampling, but I mean, adenocarcinoma, squamous cell?
Right. I think that the criteria for making that distinction in the pathology world are not probably as widely available as we would hope. But there is the other phenomena, which is a real one, that there are certainly a large number of tumors which have mixed histologies. There's adenocarcinoma and squamous histology.
I mean, is there such a thing as adenosquamous carcinoma?
There absolutely are. And I think every now and again, you see a patient in clinic who your pathologist tells you has a squamous cell tumor, and you just can't believe it. It's an ever-smoking Asian woman who walks in, and the pathologist at the other place says it's a squamous cell carcinoma, and you say, ah, well, I'll have my pathologist look at it, and they're going to say it's an adenocarcinoma. And they come back and they say, no, this is a squamous cell lung cancer. And it's always disconcerting, and sometimes that differential bothers me so much that I still look harder, and I'll often repeat the biopsy, or sometimes we even do mutation testing on the tumor. And what we found is that there are a number of patients who have squamous histology tumors on a small biopsy specimen that when we go back and we either obtain a larger specimen or just another specimen, we'll find out that they have adenocarcinoma. And it's a mixed histology tumor. And these case reports I tell you about of a never-smoking Asian woman with a squamous tumor, sometimes we find EGFR mutations in those. And so I think the notion of histology is certainly one that's complicated and requires a lot of clinical correlation. You know, you have to talk with your pathologist, the pathologist has to talk with you to really arrive at the right diagnosis and do all the right tests on a given tumor specimen that you can.
Well, listening to you makes me think that, you know, if it's maybe it's black and white in a lot of cases, but there's a bunch that aren't.
Yep.
And you can't maybe squeeze them into these categories if they don't fit.
That's exactly right. I think that sometimes maybe pathologists feel like they have to come up with a diagnosis of squamous or non-squamous or adenocarcinoma when in fact it's a poorly differentiated tumor and that's that.
As long as we're talking about selection of chemo and kind of how things have changed in the last few years, just out of curiosity, let me take a quick diversion down into adjuvant chemo. There are at least four choices that are available in the ECOG study, CIS plus or minus one of four agents. What do you think is a reasonable approach, and what do you actually do in your practice?
You know, I think sometimes in my practice and that of my colleagues, we sometimes do things that are extrapolations from other data. So if you extrapolate from the stage four non-small cell lung cancer studies, you would argue that all the platinum-based doublets are equivalent and you can use any of them in the adjuvant setting. I can't give you a rationale why, but I don't make that extrapolation in this setting. And so as such, I try to use in the adjuvant setting where I'm trying to cure patients of their non-small cell lung cancer, I use the regimen that has the most evidence associated with it, and that's the cisplatin-vinorelbine data from the NCI Canada trial.
What other options do you think are reasonable?
I think that to make the extrapolation to cisplatin docetaxel is perfectly reasonable, as well as cisplatin pemetrexed. These are equivalent platinum-based doublets in the metastatic setting. So to say that they wouldn't be appropriate in the adjuvant setting is probably wrong. I think that they seem to work just as well.
What about the adjuvant setting, you know, sort of circling back to where we began in terms of patients with EGFR mutations and ALK4 translocations?
So I think that with EGFR mutations, that's a really important story, and we have to do a better job of understanding that. You know, we've known about EGFR mutations since 2004. We've had erlotinib FDA approved since 2004. It's really incumbent upon us to have a randomized trial which compares erlotinib to placebo in patients with resected EGFR mutant lung cancer. That study is not ongoing. And it's really kind of an embarrassment in some way to clinical investigation that we haven't started to ask that question many years ago. There is an ongoing study called the RADIANT study, which takes patients who have EGFR IHC positive, so immunohistochemistry positive, non-small cell lung cancer, which has been resected, and randomizes those patients to erlotinib or placebo. Certainly that trial will obtain data on patients who have EGFR mutations, but it'll likely be underpowered to identify any real difference for those patients.
And how about ALK4? Are we ready to study it in the adjuvant setting?
Well, I think, you know, if
trizotinib, actually.
Yeah, if we're to avoid the mistakes that we've made with erlotinib, I think that that's kind of the critical next trial to develop as soon as the FDA approval of crizotinib has been sort of secured. Then I think that it's incumbent upon us to lead a trial that takes patients with resected ALK translocated lung cancer or lung cancers with ALK rearrangements and randomizes them to placebo or crizotinib. The one wrinkle to that issue may be that while ALK rearrangements occur in about 5% of patients with advanced lung cancer, it might be a somewhat lower percentage of patients with resected lung cancer, making that trial a lot harder to do.
Right. I had this thought recently. Agree or disagree, there are more non-smokers with lung cancer than patients with multiple myeloma.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right.
It's amazing when you think about it, isn't it?
Yep, absolutely.
You know, all the things that are going on in myeloma, you know?
Yep. No, I think that the number of patients who never smoked who have lung cancer, as well as any of these given molecular subsets, you know, the 20% of adenocarcinoma is EGFR mutant, and 20% of a relatively large number of patients each year, approaching 200,000, who have non-small cell lung cancer. So it represents a relatively large number of patients, and one in, you know, I think especially these molecular subtypes, we have a real hint as to what's going on with these tumors. And we've made great strides with erlotinib for EGFR mutated patients, crizotinib for ALK rearrangement patients, but these are just first steps. And we see progression-free survivals for both categories of drugs in those patients of a little under a year. And we certainly need to do a lot better for our patients than getting them 1 year of median progression-free survival.
What about other research directions in the adjuvant setting? The major ECOG trials looking at, you know, we were talking about the chemo, but the issue is chemo plus or minus Bev. What do you think about that study? What about the issue of neoadjuvant Bev, which has been looked at your institution?
Yeah, so the ECOG trial really is trying to answer that question of whether bevacizumab helps, and it's randomizing patients with resected lung cancer who have a good surgery for their lung cancer and randomizing them to either chemotherapy alone or chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. That's certainly the biggest trial ongoing in the adjuvant arena, and it's certainly one of the most anticipated results. And my understanding is it's a little over halfway accrued, and so I think that that's encouraging that we're going to get a good answer there.
Are you concerned that the two big colon trials that looked at this are negative?
I think that certainly raised a lot of eyebrows when we learned that data. But at the same time, it's a different disease, and we've certainly seen that there are differences between responses to various treatments for colorectal and lung cancer. But I think that one of the concerns that people have is that an antivascular endothelial growth factor pathway treatment may not help with management of micrometastases. And I think that that's a reasonable concern, but we're often not as smart as we think we are. So we certainly have to complete the trial and see the results.
So what about the work you all have been doing?
So we've looked at incorporating bevacizumab into induction chemotherapy. This work has really been led by Nair Rizvi at our institution. And the rationale is that, so when you see a patient who is going to go for surgery and they have a lung cancer for which you know you're going to be given chemotherapy after the surgery, you know, so really anybody with a clinical stage 2 or stage 3 lung cancer, you have the opportunity to give the chemotherapy before the surgery. And that gives you a couple advantages. One, we all know that patients who go through a thoracotomy are kind of beat up by that process. And so if you can give the chemotherapy before they get beat up by the thoracotomy, you're going to be able to deliver more chemotherapy and have a better chance of affecting their outcome. And then you also have the other great thing, which is you have an in vivo sensitivity test. You get to watch the cancer shrink on a CAT scan. You know, I think that's satisfying from a patient's perspective, and it's certainly from the oncologist's perspective. It lets you know whether you've picked the right drugs or not, and it gives you an opportunity that, you know, if you need to, you can either stop short, you can quit, or you can move to a different agent. So we've been trying to incorporate bevacizumab into that induction chemotherapy model because what you're shooting for in the induction chemotherapy setting is a response. You want to see the tumor shrink. And we know that from the ECOG 4599 data, the addition of bevacizumab to carboplatin paclitaxel significantly increased the response rate in addition to the progression-free and overall survival. So we've been combining bevacizumab with cisplatin docetaxel. One thing that's sort of a cute thing that we've added into the trial is we give the first dose of bevacizumab by itself a couple weeks before the first dose of chemotherapy just to see what effect that dose of bevacizumab has on its own. And it's kind of interesting to see. We do see tumor shrinkage with that single agent bevacizumab. It's not partial responses by any stretch for most patients, though the occasional patient has a tumor which cavitates as a result of that dose of bevacizumab. But after that single dose of bevacizumab, then patients go on to receive four cycles of cisplatin, docetaxel, and bevacizumab, then go for their operation, and then receive adjuvant bevacizumab alone in that setting. So one of the first thoughts is whether preoperative bevacizumab is dangerous. Certainly that can raise some eyebrows when you give bevacizumab, which has been associated with difficulty wound healing and a variety of other side effects. But we haven't seen a lot of significant toxicities associated with the preoperative bevacizumab. We do hold bevacizumab 6 weeks prior to the surgery, so there's probably none on board at the time of the surgery.
I guess it must be kind of hard, though, because, I mean, post-op wound complications and other kinds of complications are not unknown anyhow with surgery. I guess it might be kind of hard to tease out if there's more with the Bev.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is a non-randomized study. Everybody's getting the same treatment. And so we're left with comparing it to our historical controls at our institution or database of patients who've been previously treated. So it's not a perfect comparison.
So your third case, I see it's a 3A lung cancer. This 55-year-old woman, did she get pre-op therapy by any chance?
Yeah, she did.
So why don't we talk about her then, since you just kind of backed into it by describing the whole strategy.
Sure. And actually, this patient declined to participate in the chemotherapy trial with bevacizumab, but I gave her cisplatin docetaxel as treatment alone.
And how did she present?
Oh, she initially presented with a wheezing sound is how she described it. And she saw her primary care doctor who did a chest x-ray, and there was a right middle lobe mass. The primary care doctor then sent her for a CT scan, and that showed that right middle lobe mass and enlarged but not bulky mediastinal lymphadenopathy at the right paratracheal station. And the patient then came to see one of our thoracic surgeons. The thoracic surgeon did bronchoscopic biopsy and endobronchial ultrasound biopsy of the paratracheal lymph node on the right there and made the diagnosis of adenocarcinoma involving the right middle lobe and mediastinal lymph nodes, making the patient a T2N2 non-small cell lung cancer. The histology was adenocarcinoma.
And EGFR wild?
EGFR wild type.
And smoker?
The patient actually was a 40-pack year smoker.
So what happened?
So the patient met with the surgeon. The surgeon recommended surgery, but suggested they consider the option of induction chemotherapy. Patient came to see me, and we talked about the standard of care at our institution as well as the clinical trial, and she elected to proceed with cisplatin docetaxel without the bevacizumab. She was afraid of some of the potential risks associated with bevacizumab. And after four cycles, had about 45% shrinkage in her primary tumor, and the mediastinal lymph nodes shrank significantly. It was at that point that the patient decided that she didn't want to have surgery. And she actually elected to proceed with radiation therapy to the chest. Certainly, I wouldn't have planned induction chemotherapy followed by radiation for such a young person, but that's sort of the way it came together. And the patient received definitive radiation therapy.
And what's her current status?
Actually, disease-free 2 years later.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really wild.
Yeah.
And any problems with the radiation therapy?
No, did very well with it.
Seems like this woman knew something that we didn't know.
I sometimes think they do, and I'm hesitant to ever second guess them because they usually do.
You know, when you first said she wanted radiation, I was like, no. And then I was thinking, well,
Yep. Actually, the patient had a brother who had had lung cancer 2 years before and had been treated with radiation therapy in combination with chemotherapy and was disease-free. So she felt like he had led the way.
Well, as long as you brought that up, final question. Are you having patients getting primary radio surgery, you know, older patients, anybody?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that patients with relatively small lesions, stage 1A and even some 1B tumors, depending on where they are, can be perfectly well treated with stereotactic radiotherapy. It goes under a variety of trade names. But we've certainly seen good results, and there are some preliminary data suggesting that it's right for anybody because it may be in some ways more effective than surgery. But at the same time, in patients who would have a hard time going through surgery, whether because of poor lung function or poor functional status overall, I think this offers a great opportunity for these patients.